The following Dominican University of California production has been brought to you by radio.dominican.edu.
Good afternoon. This is Penguin Radio, radio.dominican.edu. We're here at Dominican University of California's Garden Room in Edge Hill Mansion for the Climate Change Educational Initiative Student Panel. Dr. Chase Clow will be doing the welcoming remarks momentarily here at Penguin Radio, radio.dominican.edu. Climate Change Educational Initiative, Dr. Chase Clow.
And I am the Chair of Humanities, Religion, and Philosophy, and also the coordinator of the Climate Change Educational Initiative that we've all been participating in this semester. And what a semester we've had. I just want to do a quick overview of the kinds of events and programming that we've had, which has been phenomenal. We started by learning how to find shared values and establish common ground with people who hold a very different perspective from our own. We learned from climate experts about statistical modeling and projections about global warming over the next 100 years, and those were quite devastating. We also learned about the effects of changing climate on our state and national parks and on the wildlife, and some of the steps that the National Park Service is taking to help the wildlife, and that was very interesting. And also some of the large-scale geoengineering proposals that are being considered by world governments to mitigate the effects of unsustainable CO2 levels. And I don't know about the rest of you, but those were really, I think, quite surprising, some of the things that they're considering doing. But then we watched a very hopeful film on the future of energy, particularly looking at renewable energies. And another positive actions that people are taking to address climate change, including adopting practices of mindfulness. And then on Monday night, we learned about the impressive efforts of our government to address CO2 levels, especially specifically the California government, and then the plans and actions that they plan to take going forward. And of course, we've shared a lot of readings together and a lot of really important discussions. And we've been participating in an international discourse, right? This is something that is happening around the world and leading up to the United Nations talks on climate change that are going to be held at the end of this month. So we can see that what we've been doing here is really vitally important, and we too are part of the conversation. And this evening, we're concluding this amazing semester with presentations by a number of you. And I'd like to stress the fact that one of the things to me that's very exciting about this is that you're all coming from a variety of academic disciplines. And we know that the problem of climate change is large enough that it's going to take all of us, no matter what our academic discipline or research, to address the problems. And we have to work together across disciplines in order to make a difference. So this is exciting to be able to hear what each of you are doing within your own classes. And then hopefully this conversation will go forward about ways in which we can further work together to make a change. So I extend a hearty thank you and congratulations to those of you who are presenting. I do need to make two announcements, one of which is to know that these microphones are for Penguin Radio, which is broadcasting right now. It's not to make the sound go out into the room, so you want to make sure to project. And the other thing, too, is that if someone has we're allowing time for a couple minutes for questions in between each presentation. So if you could kindly repeat the question, or at least enough of the question, so that anyone who might be listening on the radio will hear what the question was that was asked before you answer it. It's just bearing in mind that we might have an audience that's not in this room, and the sound will not carry from the back of the room into these microphones. And so now I'd like to turn the podium over to our moderator, Jathi Reed-Newt, who is the Vice President of Dominican's Green Club. And of course, I want to put in a plug for the Green Club. If you're not already a member, become one. Please, come forward. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chase. So as she introduced, my name is Jot Dirunyu. I'm your junior cinema studies and studio arts major, and today I'm going to be your moderator tonight. So first of all, this is really cool that people are presenting, and I see a lot of different majors here. And so The first person who's presenting tonight is Merit Luthi. She's a humanities and culture studies major, and for her, as part of her humanities seminar class, she's going to present on a topic called Writers in the Storm, Early Thinkers and Environmental Ethics. So please welcome Merit.
Good evening, everyone. As I've already been introduced, I'm Merit Luthi. I'm an international student and in the senior in the humanities program. The reason basically why I'm here tonight is because I would like to tell you that I've been enrolled in two classes which were concerned with the environment this semester, and I would shortly or briefly just tell you a little bit about what we learned in those classes and why it is important. For my humanities seminar, there are three particular readings I would like to address, and then I would like to talk to you about what I learned in my environmental ethics class. So in the humanities seminar, the first reading that I would like to talk to you about is called Riders on the Storm, and it's by Brian Henning, a professor in philosophy and environmental studies at Gonzaga University in Washington. I remember this particular reading because it made me feel extremely uncomfortable. And it made me aware that this exact discomfort is probably why so many people choose to look away, because it just makes them feel uncomfortable and they try to hide this reality. Despite that I've been growing up in a Western European country and I've been aware about the environmental issues basically pretty much my whole life, this text still made me feel uncomfortable because it basically shows the reader that climate change is not coming, it's here already. And I wonder if Henning intentionally tried to make this reading so feeling so uncomfortable in order to call the layperson to action. It is very factual and scientific based, but it is also written in a way that the layperson can relate to it. Hennings, for example, explains how difficult it is to demonstrate how a specific event, such as Hurricane Katrina, for example, are caused by climate change. But however, he also shows that climate change can influence the frequency and intensity of such events directly. He also explains how the rate of climate change is drastically accelerated, and that humans have a direct influence on that rate. He talks about all kinds of devastating events we will face in the near future, such as storms, droughts, and mass relocation due to increased water levels or other events that will make places particularly hard to live in or undesirable. In short, he talks about all those uncomfortable events that people try to look away from. The other two readings I would like to address are older than this one, but they are nevertheless important. They're less scientific and they're more addressing our morals. So the one I first like to talk is called A Sandy County Almanac by Aldo Leopold, a scientist, author, and conservationist. I'm so sorry. So the piece was written in 1949. He starts off the story by talking, he starts his writing about the story of the cranes who lived in symbiosis in marshlands, which were created over centuries and longer. How symbiosis then was not enough for the humans and not enough profitable after all. And basically the same old story, how humans destroyed the symbiosis in a second compared to how long it took to be created. He uses beautiful language that appeals to our morals. It's not facts or science in these terms, but it's on a different level. Leopold continues his story with the journey of an atom called X. He explains how X started out in a limestone millions of years ago, how the X traveled through the circles of life, how it was released as the rock decayed, and how it helped create a flower, became an acorn that fed a deer, and how the deer eventually fed a human. And how after this person died, that the journey of X continued until it ended in the ocean once again. Leopold basically illustrates how everything is intertwined, how we run in circles, and how long-lasting evolution is compared to the fast-acting destructive powers of humans. The last reading I would like to address from the Humanities Seminar was called Man in Nature. It dates back to 1864 and it was written by George Perkins Marsh, America's first conservationist. It was extremely interesting because it showed me how people were concerned with the environment for a long time, and how nevertheless we proceeded with our invasion of the environment. Marsh was considered the fountainhead of the conservation movement, as he was among the first to notice and wrote about the changes in the local climate. He also directly helped to protect parks in the New York area and indirectly for the creation of new national parks and reserves. Perkins Marsh basically wrote about the imbalance humans have brought upon nature, how nature has very few means to defend itself from our destructive actions. He compares the human to a predator, to beasts, but how nature can, different from humans, how nature can defend itself or has the ability to counterbalance other beasts. He also mentions, that was very interesting, how humans destroy even what they cannot consume. And basically hence shows how useless or unnecessary many of our actions are. He also says that we have exceeded the capacities of many natural capacities, how we have felled enough forests, and that we won't act until our actions return to us, threats to us. And if we keep in mind that this was written in 1864, I really wonder how disappointed, how devastated he would be if he would live today. Lastly, I would briefly like to tell you about my environmental ethics class and why it was important and what I learned. Basically, like any other environmental ethics class, we looked at the different models of ethics, the different approaches such as duty, character ethics, relationships, rights, and the consequences. However, in this class, we learned that all those models also apply directly to nature. Not going into much detail about those different models, I just would like to point out to you that no matter which model we consider, we always end up with the idea that we have or we must consider the environment. For example, if we accept that nature has intrinsic worth, we just must care for it simply because for what it's worth. We have to treat it as end and not as means. On the other hand, if one cannot relate to this rather abstract idea, we might still care and protect nature because, as we have seen, everything is intertwined and runs in circles. Our actions have direct influence on the environment. And the environment indirectly also, directly again also to other people alive today or yet to come. So if we care about other people, we have a duty to care for nature. Lastly, I would also like to tell you what I did in my for my action plan and involvement plan in my environmental class. It is a project that, like many others, project like this, does not get much public attention. It is a project proposed by the Glen Canyon Institute. It's called Fill Lake Meet First. Basically, the Glen Canyon Institute has collected many data and a lot of data and conducted studies, which basically show that the way the water reserve system over in Utah, Arizona, Nevada is set up right now with Lake Powell and the restricted Colorado River and Lake Mead is not working as it was intended to work. And with more climate changes and droughts, the situation is getting even worse. So basically, they are proposing to drain Lake Powell, let Colorado River run free, and use Lake Mead as a primary water source. There are many details about it on the website. I'm not going into those, but it looks like a very promising idea. So if you got time and want to check it out, again, it's called Glen Canyon Institute, and the project is called Fill Lake Mead First. To conclude my speech, I would just like to ask all of you that when you go home tonight, look, open your eyes, open your heart, look at the stars, look at the tree or the grass you're walking off, and just embrace nature for what it is. Or maybe sign up for another environmental class, because as we know, education is an important step to win this battle against climate change. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Merritt. And next up, we have Sierra Carlson and Alex Fuentes, who are chemistry majors, juniors. And as part of their quantitative chemical analysis class, they're going to talk about the determination of carbon dioxide in our air, a key to understanding global climate change. So please welcome the two wonderful juniors.
Hi, I'm Alex Fuentes.
And I'm Sierra Carlson. And we're on the radio.
Oh, yay. This is our determination of the level of CO2 in our atmosphere, and this is for San Rafael as of October and November of 2015.
So here's a picture of our Earth. You can see the blue ring around the outside is meant to represent our atmosphere. Greenhouse gases in our atmosphere include carbon dioxide, methane, and dinitrogen monoxide. And what these gases do is they absorb infrared radiation and get into an excited state, and then once they relax again, they release that energy as heat, and they warm us up on Earth.
So these are the really basics of our planet. We get most, if not all, of our energy from our sun, 93 million miles away. And as of right now, our surface temperature of our beautiful sun is almost 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And the Earth's average temperature today is usually around 59 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's because of the beautiful greenhouse gases we have. And it's actually okay that we have some, because without it, it would be 0 degrees Fahrenheit, and we'd all be very cold all the time.
So Charles David Keeling began measuring the amount of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere in 1956, and he measured it at Mauna Loa because it's far away from any industrial activity, so that wouldn't sway the data that he collected. And what you can see here, this is the data that he has. You can see that there's a pretty steady increase as we go on until today, about 2 parts per million, which seems pretty small, but it actually has a pretty big impact.
Now, this beautiful illustration actually is from NOAA. These is the data that has been retrieved from ice core samples in Antarctica, and this is going back almost 1,000 years, and that black squiggle is the data from Antarctica, and the red, almost vertical line is the CO2 increase that came from keeling. So this is a really strong indicator of what the CO2 levels have risen significantly since our beautiful Industrial Revolution.
Okay, so along with our quantitative analysis class, we decided to recreate Charles Keeling's experiment using the equipment that we have in our own laboratory to measure the amount of carbon dioxide in the air here at San Rafael.
We had to sort of make up this procedure as we went, considering we have limited resources here. So the main thing we did was we got three rather big flasks that we then purged with nitrogen. And after we had purged the nitrogen, we also needed to purge our IR. And when we were doing that, we had some struggles, mostly because either we ran out of nitrogen, or when you go to open up the door to place the cell in and our sample, you let the nitrogen out. So it was a very on and off thing to try and do that. Our cell also needed to be purged as well in order for us to get rid of our little carbon dioxide sample. And we would then take different parts per million of CO2 and inject it into one of each flask. One sample had 150, the other 300, and then our last one was 450 parts per million. Once we were able to stick it in the jar, we would take 5 30-mil aliquots of the big gas and put it into our little itty-bitty cell and then measure the absorbance of that. From there, we got our total data points, and we were able to calculate the carbon dioxide concentration in our atmosphere.
So this is the standard curve that we calculated using our big flask that had a standard amount of carbon dioxide. And so what we did is, all right, so here's the spectrum that comes out of the IR, and those peaks right there with the line going across to the top, that shows the carbon dioxide. And so if we plug in the absorbance that we get there into our line of best fit, we can calculate the amount of carbon dioxide in our air. And so what we ended up calculating on average was 468.5 parts per million. The data amount collected at Mauna Loa today in October is 398.29 parts per million, which is 2.3 more than it was a year ago, which goes along with the average trend that we've been seeing in the past.
So this is just a beautiful visual representation of carbon as in the form of what the ocean emits, what the ocean absorbs, what the land emits, and what the land absorbs, as well as the contribution fossil fuels has had to the beautiful equilibrium that used to be before our Industrial Revolution. Now, as you can kind of tell, the numbers are really tiny, so I'm sorry if you can't see it, but land output is around 120, and the output's 120, and the input's around 120 as well, trillion tons of carbon per year. Our ocean releases almost 100 trillion and absorbs 100 trillion. But with our burning fossil fuels, you release 6.5 trillion, but you don't absorb any of it. So that's just an extra piece that just throws the whole balance out of whack. And the increase, like Sierra said, has been almost 2.3 parts per million a year.
Yeah, or 3 trillion tons. Seems a lot bigger than 2.3 parts per million. So what all of this means for us, so if any of you have heard of ocean acidification, the carbon dioxide in our air is reacting with ocean water to create carbonic acid. And what this does is it disintegrates corals, and that has a huge impact on ocean wildlife because they rely on these coral reefs to survive. And so in addition to that, their exoskeletons are also being disintegrated. And so we can also see an increase in plant growth because they use carbon dioxide in photosynthesis to create energy. And most importantly, we see our own Earth heating up because we're basically just adding more and more blankets onto our Earth, and so we're just retaining the heat instead of releasing it as much as we used to. And thank you.
Yeah.
Questions? It's very scientific.
If we need to explain anything, really, we'll try.
Where did you get the air samples from?
Inside the Science Center on campus.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It was the easiest to do in our short laboratory period during class. This was all done during class time.
Oh.
So we didn't really have time to go out.
You would have gone to downtown.
Yeah, maybe we should go to Mount Tamalpais and get data and then go to the city and get data.
Yeah?
Well, it just made me wonder if there was air conditioning in the building at the time and if that would have had any impact on the amount of air.
It was done in the morning, and just from working in the Science Center, I know we don't traditionally turn on the air conditioning until around, in the winter, we'd try not to turn it on. But I mean, some of our stuff has to stay cold, so we have no choice in life. I think during the winter we don't really turn it on until at least 11:30, and this was done early in the morning, so that would be a really great thing to find out. I have no idea.
It was also taken from a really small room with a lot of people inside of it, where we're all breathing out carbon dioxide into the cell. and we had trouble getting the carbon dioxide out of the instrument in the first place, so
yeah,
there's an increase there.
Yeah, the CO2 we actually ended up injecting into each of the flasks was taken from an actual canister about this tall of CO2 after putting it through a cleaning process just to make sure it was CO2. So we didn't just exhale into a giant flask. I feel like that would have been priceless to watch, but no.
Any more questions? Well, thank you very much.
That was cool. I learned a lot of stuff. Wow. And next up is Sierra Nola, and she is a history major. And part of her digital storytelling class, she's going to talk about history of climate change. So please welcome her.
Good evening. My name is Sierra Nodrolia, and I am a sophomore history major. My presentation is essentially a visual history of climate change on a global scale and shows how corruption has led to the environmental conditions of today. And for those of you who are not here to see it, you can find it on YouTube under my name, SIERRANAJOLIA, and Environment Project. Thank you. Any questions? I know it's a lot to take in at once, but yes, Mateo.
Why did you use those particular songs?
The song, I really liked it. I thought it was impactful and dramatic. Thank you. I was trying to go for a high impact message. Yes.
A lot of your slides did not appear to be about climate. Many of them appear to be about human rights violations of one kind or another. So why did you combine those two things?
My mission in showing those pictures was showing movement and change and how we have revolted against previous regimes and establishments and have won. So I wanted to show that it's been done in history, that we can revolt, we can change. So I wanted to show how it's been done in the past so you can see we can do it in the future. Any other questions? Yes.
Where did you produce that? I'm interested in the technical putting together the film.
Final Cut Pro, actually, in the Comm Lab. It's funny, I'm a history major. This is my first time taking any communications courses and or even working a Mac computer. So I had to learn this all by myself from knowing nothing. So it was a lot of work.
That's a dynamite project.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions? All right, thank you.
Hello, that was excellent. So next up with the Sarah Trejo, Sandra Akiura, and Isabel Penner, who are communications major and part of their digital storytelling project. They're going to show a film about the effect of rising sea levels in Marin County. So please welcome Sarah and Isabel.
Hi, I'm Isabel. I'm a sophomore communications major, and this is Syrah. She's also a sophomore communications major. And we did our film on rising sea levels in Marin County and what the concerns are with that and what we can also do to help combat the rising sea levels.
This film and this topic really caught our attention because we are we live in Marin. We're all residents of San Rafael. And we looked at San Rafael in particular because we're right next to the San Rafael Bay, which is part of the San Pablo Bay, and just the whole, all of Marin is surrounded by water. So when sea levels go up, it will affect most of Marin. So I hope that you can look at this film and really think about what sea level rise means and how it is a problem that is affecting all of us.
Increases, the amount of snow and ice that traps the water, as that decreases, we have more water in the environment, and it's going to go into the ocean, and the oceans are going to rise.
Sea level rise has begun to threaten coastal communities around the world. In the United States, cities like Miami are already seeing the impact of sea level rise. Our planet is changing rapidly, and our communities are not prepared to handle the changes. We have built our cities on low-lying land as well as filled in land. This combination has led the ocean to overtake sinking land.
The land we're standing on now is actually filled in, and when the bay rises up, it will reclaim its territory.
The challenges that Miami is facing now foreshadow what may happen here in Marin. Marin County is a maritime community. The proximity to the water makes Marin an attractive place to live.
A large percentage of the world's population lives on or near a coast.
Marin County is surrounded by three major bodies of water. The eastern shore borders the San Pablo and San Francisco Bay. The San Francisco Bay also runs around southern Marin, while the western edge of Marin opens up to the Pacific Ocean. Closer to San Rafael is the San Rafael Bay, which is part of the San Pablo Bay. A tributary of the San Rafael Bay, San Rafael Creek runs through the city of San Rafael. The creek's placid water will pose a threat to surrounding businesses and infrastructure when sea levels rise.
The canal area has been mostly dry since 1982, but very small floods have occurred since then.
Juan de la Calle, a longtime resident of the canal area, vividly remembers the flood of
1982. cuando no hay como qué manera salir vivo, está hinchado en la calle, ¿de qué manera va a salir vivo?
Small amounts of rise in sea level are going to mean that when we have storms coming through, there's no longer that sort of buffer that we used to have, which was that houses were a couple of feet above sea level. As we use that buffer up, we're going to find that as storms roll through, as typhoons and hurricanes roll through, as storm surges roll through, they're going to more directly address, they're going to more directly impact and be more devastating.
The County of Marin has begun to look at the issue of sea level rise. Jack Leibster from the Marin Planning Commission is directly involved with efforts to address the problem.
A flooded parking lot is a problem, but a flooded electrical substation that wipes out the electricity for an entire neighborhood or city, or a wastewater treatment plant that gets flooded and emits untreated waste throughout the area, that's a bigger problem.
In fact, the Bay Conservation and Development Commission predicts that water in the San Francisco Bay will rise up to 16 inches by 2050 and by 55 inches 50 years after that. Lori Williams from Marin County Flood Control and Lauren Armstrong from Marin County Community Agency discussed proposed solutions to combat sea level rise.
We're working on longer-term solutions to flooding, so not like sandbagging, something you can do in these upcoming storms, but looking at the entire watershed and how the water functions through there and working with our partners in the watershed to come up with longer-term solutions that we would then seek funding for to implement. And all of those solutions have to include sea level rise, resiliency to them. A lot of the solutions we're talking about aren't going to happen for 20 or so years, and the tides and the waters are rising now.
We just want people to be prepared in the meantime. It's going to be a slow emergency, so we have time to deal with it. There's three different major categories. One is to leave the area, which is very difficult and politically sensitive, and sometimes there's nowhere to leave to.
It has always been that the areas closest to the oceans are some of the most populated.
Sometimes it's actually removing levees. It actually brings the tides in. When the tides go out, they scour more of the sediments out, which deepens the channel.
Obviously, we're always going to need to do dredging in our marinas and the channels that require navigation. So adaptation is a huge part of it. In a community like ours with all these baylands, some of what we need to do for sea level rise is good for wetlands, because wetland restoration can provide a really wonderful natural buffer.
Beyond that, then you say we can defend where we are with hard engineering options.
But there's going to be some infrastructure that'll need to be hardened and elevated. So we're going to need to invest a lot more in our bayside and oceanside communities, and that's one of the things that I'm trying to get funding for.
Rising and raging waters don't respect city limit lines or county boundaries, nor are they constrained by departmental organization charts or what special district has which responsibilities. The silos between departments need to become more permeable at all levels, city, county, all around, and the cooperation expanded among different local governments and different agencies with functional responsibilities.
If we can slow the pace at which we're adding carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, we will not stop climate change, and therefore we will not stop sea level rise, but we can mitigate it by having it occur more slowly, and we can start the turn that would bring us back into a better situation.
And so we'd like to open it up to questions, if any of you guys have questions. Yes?
This is just a comment.
Mm-hmm.
The part of where Third Street goes to San Pedro Road,
mm-hmm.
Much of San Pedro Road near where I live flooded at the last king tide. It was underwater.
Yeah.
There are maps. You can go online and find maps of projected sea level rise, and one that I saw not too long ago was that at the current rate, the edge of the bay in about 100 years will be somewhere around Grand Street and Mission. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could be, our own campus could just really be on the edge of the bay. So, yeah.
As some of the people we interviewed, this is a slow emergency. It's something that we find when there's catastrophes, we're fast to respond and we're on the ground and there. Take for example an earthquake that brings down an overpass or a bridge, but this is a slow emergency. So it's something that we need to be made aware of and have access to the information and know what the county and what the city is doing about it. Any other comments or questions? Yeah.
Do you know like how exactly we could, or just a general question, do you know like how we could slow or reverse sea level rise potentially?
So with the warming of our environment, what we understand, the warming of our environment is what's causing sea levels to rise. So we can't really reverse it. There's no way to reverse it. Professor Young explained that the Earth goes through cycles of sea level rise and when the sea level falls. It's something that just happens throughout thousands of years, millions of years. So the way to respond to it is, you know, adaptation. We can't really stop it. We have to adapt. There's no really fixed line where it's land and water. That's not the way the Earth works. But in our minds, that's the way we believe it to be. So just adapting to it.
Hopefully someone thinks of a really good idea.
Yeah.
Somehow reverse it, like send it to space or something.
Well, anyway, thank you very much. We really appreciate you taking the time to watch this.
So next up, we will be presenting a project by Milena Sensi, and she's a humanities and culture studies major, and now she's going to talk about dialectic of environmental stewardship.
Good evening, my name is Milena Sensi, and I'm a senior in the humanities and cultural studies. Climate change is undeniable. The facts and figures back our experiences. For example, an unseasonably warm summer combined with a terrible drought led to devastating wildfires. One that touched us personally was the Valley Fire. Professor of Philosophy and Environmental Studies at Gonzaga University, Brian G. Henning, states in his book, Writers in the Storm, Ethics in an Age of Climate Change, Earth experienced at least 400 years worth of warming in one century. Are we prepared to defend our positions on the environment and take action? Our roles within the environment are now at the forefront. Next month, global leaders will converge on Paris, France, to collaborate and support initiatives that will begin to reverse and restore the damage inflicted upon our world. A lot of positive ideas and advanced thinking will be generated at this summit. However, it is disappointing that we've reached a critical junction that has forced the issue of climate change when this is not a recent topic or idea. This semester in the humanities seminar, we examined various texts and learned that environmental stewardship date back to the beginning of time, and climate change was examined by prominent writers. It is only within the last 150 years that we have actively studied climate change. Ancient religions and texts promote a common thread of stewardship for Earth and its inhabitants. From the Amplified Bible, in the book of Genesis, chapter 2, verse 15, "And the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and guard and keep it." Many of us rely upon our religious beliefs as a guide for tackling life's challenges. Why not dig into our faith to provide a starting point for environmental stewardship? What does stewardship entail? What's in the job description? A steward may be the person in charge, an administrator, the responsible team leader, an attendant, or a representative. When we examine our individual positions, can we say that we've been good stewards of our natural resources? according to George Perkins Marsh, who is considered to be the first environmentalist and put forth the idea of sustainability, in his book, Man and Nature, the answer is no. But man is everywhere, a disturbing agent. Wherever he plants his foot, the harmonies of nature are turned to discords. The proportions and accommodations which ensured the stability of existing arrangements are overthrown. We have the opportunity and responsibility to change this perception of humans and our relationship with the environment. As administrators of policy and law, we have a responsibility to uphold a land ethic. We have been successful through proper maintenance of our national parks. However, a comprehensive land ethic encompasses more. In his book, A Sand County Almanac, Aldo Leopold states, "The land ethic simply enlarges the boundaries of the community to include soils, waters, plants, and animals, or collectively, the land. Actively participating in opportunities to include more areas into national parks, support for local parks and preserves advances the land ethic, but we must not assume that boundaries to the parks is where our task ends. It's our backyards, schools, places of employment, and shared spaces. Environmental stewards vote for choices that are in the best interest of the environment. It is easier for humans to adapt than plants and animals." A conscious environmental steward makes time to connect to the land physically and spiritually. Have you had the opportunity to participate in a garden? Dirty hands, chafed knees, and aching backs seem to add a certain flavor to the food you are eating, or brightness to the colors of the flowers. Author Henry David Thoreau, in his book Huckleberries, states it perfectly. "I believe in a different kind of division of labor, that Professor D should be encouraged to divide himself freely between his library and the huckleberry field." There is a certain satisfaction and level of gratification when you produce your own food, be it growing or foraging. Finally, environmental stewards share their knowledge and experiences to further the cause and recruit new members. We must not let our fellow man miss out on the amazing opportunity of protecting and guarding our environment. I don't want to be what climate blogger R.L. Miller calls a climate zombie, without purpose and wasting resources. In his book, Writers in the Storm, Brian G. Henning reiterates that we stop ignoring the evidence and quit asking for more data, because when we finally agree that we have all of the information to make a decision, it will be too late. Thank you. Questions, comments? No? Thank you.
So hello, everyone, and just being at this event just tells you that to, you know, educate people about climate change, you can actually have a lot of different approaches. Like, we saw like films about it, we saw it through like humanities, we saw it through like photography, we can do it through music or anything. So whatever field you are in, this is a topic that I personally think that we should all care about, and you can actually be like part of it, even if it's small. And one way to be part of, you know, the climate change movement is joining the Green Club. We're looking for new members and new board members too. So if you're interested, talk to me. Let us, and I can let you know like what we're doing, and then, you know, all the projects that we have in mind. And one of the biggest things that we're thinking right now is to kind of enforce Dominican administration to divest from fossil fuels and, you know, invest in renewable energy. So, yeah, if any of you are, and then what we need right now is the support from the student body, because John always tells this to us, like, if you're in college, like in this college, like, to change the policies and everything, the power is in the students' hands, not the faculty. We're the ones who can complain. So yeah, we're more powerful than like the faculty member to talk to the administration and say, hey, I'm not happy about this. We should change it. So I feel like we should really use, you know, what like that as, you know, our advantage. So if, yeah, go ahead.
How far along is Dominican in divesting?
Very far.
Very far.
I think we're still like, this just came up, and we've been talking to Chase about this too. And there are, there's Ken Jones from 350 Marin Organization who is willing to like help us. And there are some like few people that I've talked to past month. So and then what we need right now is I need more student support, like people who want to, you know, be part of this with me rather than the faculty who are all very supportive. So if any of you are interested, that'd be great. So yeah, that's about the Korean Club and what we're doing.
Thank you. One other thing that we've been talking about with 350 Marin is the possibility of more solar power on campus, and we may even actually have an external investor who might be willing to help make that happen. So we're really excited about that. I do want to let you know that some of the materials that have been offered throughout the semester are available on Dominican Scholar. So scholar.dominican.edu. If you go under events, you can find the climate change. We do have all of the recordings from the panel of the three scientists who came, and all of their presentations are available there. My hope is to also put tonight's event up there. We'll be doing a slideshow and any other materials that we can gather. So if you, those of you who showed films, if you would like to have your film be part of that, we'd welcome to have it. Anybody who presented a paper, you can submit your paper. It will become a part of the permanent archive of the university. And it's our way, again, of registering in history that we, too, care about this really important problem and that we're thinking hard about what to do about it. So, Mari, yes.
I'm Mari Pileggi, and I'm with Communication and Media Studies. And I think Jolly made a really good point that students are really a powerful voice here, and I just want to really underscore, we have the student radio, we're on it now. It's a way to really make your voice heard. We have a student newspaper. Some of you in here are part of the newspaper. It's another way to get your ideas out. We also have classes here that have environmental focus. Ken Frost, his chemistry class is here.
Ken, I know there are other science courses that have an environmental focus. Certainly we saw Amy Young and some of her classes. I believe John has a class next semester in environmental documentary. Chase has a class next semester on the spirit of the earth. I teach a course in the fall semester, environmental communication. The beginnings of a way to really get you thinking and acting more, and then talking with each other and letting other people know about the passion that you have about the environment. Thank you.
So we'll just end with Ken Frost saying a little something. So Ken and Mari were both with me on the organizing committee for this. So again, thank you both so much. And to the others, Mia Tech Kolopinski, who else was on there? Randy Hall, John Duvall, John, pardon me, and Laura Stivers. So thank you.
Well, I didn't mean to be the Omega presenter tonight, but I did think that it was worthwhile to sound a note of optimism and about local initiative. The Marin Carbon Project, now probably 6 years old, developed a method for enhancing the fertility of rangeland. And in doing so, the rangeland is more fertile and more photosynthetic activity happens, i.e., the grass grows taller. The important thing for the climate is that the roots grow deeper too. And as they do, just like our own stomachs, the root mass is surrounded by a bacterial bloom that helps the plants grow, helps them absorb the nutrients from the soil. This process has the power to bring down the CO2 level. The Marin Carbon Project, now under the banner of the Carbon Cycle Institute, has actually a protocol which you can purchase and sell your carbon credits in the carbon market today to try and mitigate what's happening with the CO2 level. In California, if we were to put a quarter inch layer of compost on top of our rangeland in the northern part of California, that would compensate for all of our residential and commercial emission. So it's big, but the power is big, the volume is big, the number of hectares that have to be treated is huge. So it's a huge project, but it's something worth embracing. And it does speak to what happens when carbon dioxide pollution runs amok. Thank you.
Can I ask a quick question? I'll just ask it here. So do you feel that our current agricultural system could benefit from this knowledge, meaning we've moved to a very industrial agricultural system in California, if they had a different way of farming? Would that make a difference in terms of carbon?
Absolutely. Chase brings up a very good point. And it's the difference between plowing and tilling and not. That when we turn the soil over, we basically release most of that carbon dioxide that was held in the strata between right at the surface and up to about 10 feet below the surface. When we turn that over, we let the CO2 out. We let those carbons out as oxidation of the carbohydrate masses that were there. So, yes, there is, and there are lots of people working on this. It's not like we just invented it. People are doing it. It is having an impact. But, you know, students matter.
Okay, and any other final questions? Anybody, any question that for any of the faculty who are here or of one another? I think, yes, you have a question? Okay, she's asking if there are plans to do other panels like this in future semesters. Not at the moment, but I definitely think we need to start planning. So if this is something that you're interested in and you'd like us to keep this conversation going, please contact me or Mari or Ken, and let's start planning. I think it's really important. Thank you. Who else? Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
When does the Green Club meet?
When does the Green Club meet?
We meet on Wednesdays.
Wednesdays. Seven.
Once in Fanjo Student Union. What's been happening for the past few weeks is right now we only have two board members, so it's been kind of like difficult to people stop showing up.
There aren't enough people showing up, so they need more. Okay, sorry to keep repeating. I just wanted to make sure that this is heard again by any listeners that we have outside. I would love it if just one of you would be willing to say anything about what this has meant to you, this series of events that we've done, this concentration or focus on climate change and global warming. Anybody, anything you'd like to share? Yes. Yeah, come on up. And anybody else? Anyone else? Yay! Yeah. And anyone else who's brave enough to come, please just come walk up here so you can take the mic next.
Oh, that's right. Hi, Sister Pat, and hi, Dr. Ross, if you're listening. Anyway, I've had the pleasure of studying climate change in two fronts, both as a biologist and as someone who studies the international levels, but I've never actually attended a seminar that combined both, and I thought that was really helpful. I found that studying it from a biological perspective, we get kind of rooted in the science of it all and don't look at it from a communications point of view, which is equally as important when you're dealing with an international issue like this, which it is. So I thought that it was very helpful, and I'm glad you guys did it, because it definitely presents facts and stuff like that in ways that people who maybe aren't as well-versed in the lingo can understand, and makes it something a lot more applicable to everybody else, because it is an issue that affects everybody and shouldn't just be studied on one front.
Thank you.
I'm Sarah, a sophomore communication major, and I thought this is a great opportunity to really explore a topic that I didn't know much about. We all have a general perspective and you have a general knowledge about climate change from what we hear in the news, but a lot of it is skewed and a lot of it comes from different partisan, I would say, ideas of what it is. And so this project really gave me and my partners, Isabel and Sandra Aikiora, a chance to explore a topic that is relevant to the place that we live. And, you know, we got to interview Congressman Jared Huffman, which is such an honor to be able to talk to him. And that was possible because of Monday's event, the Climate Initiative. It was a California to U.S. to Paris. And so this has been a really great experience, I think. And as our colleague said, sometimes it's really hard to find the true message behind all the science and making it accessible to people. So I want to thank everyone for putting this together, and thank you for really caring about this issue. And also thank you to Mari for all your support throughout this project.
I'm up again, so I'm Jock, and just wanted to say that, like, earlier this semester, as part of Dr. Sinclair's class, we, yes, Dr. Sinclair is there, and we had a guest speaker who's a Native American scholar came to our class and, you know, talk about what Native American religion means, and one of the things he talked about was how it's important for a human being as yourself to connect to the earth that you're living. Yes, like all the impacts that we've been doing, you know, contributing to the climate change. But even without thinking all the negative effects that we've been doing to the earth, even just think about like your own personal connection to the earth and how it feels to you. Because I feel like most of us are really ignorant about like the place that we're living here. Like, oh yeah, I'm on Earth and I'm doing whatever I have to. But think about what kind of things you are doing to, you know, the place that you're living. Think about like what, like appreciating what the nature actually has. And then, so I think it's really important for us to, you know, notice that. And then it's been great to just like hear all the events and then that happened on campus, so thank you so much for that. And heads up, Green Club, talk to me.
So I'm John Duvall, I teach in communication and media studies, and I'm also the faculty sponsor of the Student Green Club. And I want to give a shameless plug for my documentary, environmental documentary film class that's going to be offered in this coming semester, where you can make a short documentary either about local environmental issues or about big environmental issues. But what I really want to say is this. You students just don't know how much power you have. You are the customers of this university, and believe me, they listen to you more than they listen to me or to us. If there's something that's bugging you, if you wish we had outdoor recycling bins, or if you wish we had electric hand dryers instead of throwaway paper towels in the bathrooms, or if you wish the president would sign the president's climate commitment, or if you wish the university would subscribe to Marin Clean Energy, which we don't, tell somebody. Tell ASDU. Tell the president, tell your faculty, your teachers, and your other advisors. We could do so much. We could do so much at Dominican if we just sort of had people rise up and say, hey, what about this? So please join me, join Chot, and let's get some things done around here. Thank you.
Last chance for anybody else who wants to share anything? No? Okay. Well, thank you all for a great semester. Keep going. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you so very much for listening today to the Climate Change Educational Initiative program at radio.dominican.edu.